The Ticket.
Podcasts are brought to you in part by Lewis Jewelers, the official jeweler of The Ticket and proud partner of Michigan Athletics.
And we are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider Sports Talk 1050 WTKA online at WTKA.com. Sam Webb and Mr. Ira Weintraub on the other side of the county. He is inside the Emden Studios over at Ann Arbor Radio. I, meanwhile, am in my home office, the Webb Studio, as I have now dubbed it. And, you know, practicing social distancing, right? The stay-at-home order. Well, we are slowly but surely coming back online. And boy, oh boy, this weekend, with the holiday weekend, you can certainly anticipate, folks getting out and inevitably being in spaces with a lot of people. A lot of folks may be traveling north that, the areas of the northern lower peninsula have been online. And so can imagine what the population is going to be in those places coming up this weekend. So the importance of maintaining some of the, measures that we have been, following here over the last couple of months has never been greater. And joining us to talk about that, help prepare you for the holiday weekend, answer some of the pressing questions, we go back over to our great friends at Michigan Medicine, some unbelievable people, of course, for the important work they're doing on the front lines, but also for their ability to come on and talk to us in lay terms about what we need to do and separate fact from fiction. The latest doctor to help us with that, Dr. Daniel Call, joins us this morning, a doctor whose specialty is infectious disease and internal medicine, and here to impart some wisdom upon us. Dr. Call, how are you doing this morning?
Very good, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you taking the time. So you said, you guys have so much important work to do on the front line. So to take a fraction of that time to come spend with us, to talk about some of the things that we need to know is really welcome and appreciate it. But as I do with all of you guys that come on, I just want to start out with asking you how you're doing. You guys have a juggling act to do with the work you do on the front lines and then also your family. So how are you and your people in your family dealing with all of this at this time?
Well, thanks for asking, Sam. I've got basically three, college age and late high school kids, and one is still out in college, and two are home, and we got a puppy to keep them busy, but we're hanging in there.
Yeah, good to hear, Dr. Call, and I, in the lead-in, as you heard, talked about what this weekend is going to look like, what I anticipate it looking like, and not just here in the state of Michigan, but across the country. And, it just seems like, and tell me if you get this impression, just seems like to me that a lot of folks, because the numbers are declining, are starting to believe that we are on the other side of this battle. And I think perception is a thing to really be focused on about why we are where we are with the numbers and how easily there can be an uptick. So can you address that for the listeners?
Absolutely, Sam. I think you hit the nail on the head. Unfortunately, the virus doesn't care about our holiday, and it doesn't care about how we'd like the summer to go. And since while we had a pretty bad outbreak ongoing in southeastern Michigan and through various other parts of the state, most people have not been infected. And so if we go back to what we were doing before we locked everything down, the exact same thing we observed in March and April will just come roaring back, and we'll have many more deaths and, hospitals getting close to overwhelmed, right on the edge, like many of the hospitals in Detroit were. So I think that it's appropriate to start opening things up, but to think that we're on the other side of this, unfortunately, is really far-fetched.
Yeah, and so as we look at people getting back out and being in highly populated settings now, getting into some of the best practices, I think, is important. So I know I've touched on this with doctors that have come on before, but the masks continue to be an issue, Dr. Call. I mean, there are folks that just, you know, accurately cite that initially we were being told, you know, wearing a mask doesn't make sense. Now, you know, here over the last, you know, month and a half, very much the message has been in encouraging, you know, of wearing masks, mandatory wearing masks in some areas. So if you could explain to the people what the masks that we in the public are wearing, what they do and don't do, who the protection is for and isn't for when you wear a mask.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sam, you're entirely right. The guidance has changed. And part of that is, you know, for the medical community and epidemiologists and the infectious disease community, you know, we were trying to feel our way through this too at the beginning, but we've learned quite a bit as time's gone on. And so one thing that seems very clear is that most of the spread of this is through people coughing, speaking loudly, singing, all those kinds of things in group settings where the particles come out and somebody else breathes them in, and then they get sick. And so the masking appears to be a key intervention where you wear that mask, you're not able to spread the particles nearly as easily, and so you're primarily, 90% of the benefit is protecting other people. And I think it's a shame that it's become sort of politicized and has become almost a symbol of things that it ought not to be. It's really just a public health intervention that, to me, is a respectful thing to do, especially when we're in indoor settings, to help protect the vulnerable among us and to protect those around us, even if it doesn't necessarily provide a lot of protection for ourselves.
All right. So that is a key point, because I, you know, obviously, intuitively, you think I put on a mask for me. And so you got a lot of folks that, you know, they feel, you know, they feel their personal space, you know, their right to choose is being infringed upon for something that is about their health and welfare. So if I don't want to wear a mask and I'm willing to assume the risk of not wearing a mask, leave me alone is the mindset of some. But what I hear you illustrating verbally for us once again is that when you wear a mask, it's about other people. It's about protecting the folks around you, right?
Yeah, and it goes even, I think, one step further. Absolutely, it's about protecting those around us. But in another way, it protects those around us, because the more that this spreads, since many or a significant proportion of people don't get much in the way of symptoms or minimal symptoms, and you may not know it, and then you're spreading it all over the place, potentially, and getting a whole bunch of people sick. And I don't know anybody who wants to do that. And then the epidemic grows and the economy has to lock down again. And so, you know, I think every reasonable intervention that people can make, and I think for the vast majority of people, wearing a mask when they're in a crowded settings is not, you know, really going to impair their breathing or anything. It's just the right thing to do right now.
We are this morning talking to Dr. Daniel Call from over at Michigan Medicine, specialty being infectious disease and internal medicine. Certainly very on time for us here on this show this morning. Doc, we, you know, there was some commentary out of Ohio State, you know, as we see college sports talk about the fall and what they might look like in the fall. Talking about fans in the stands, and a very consistent theme of a reduced capacity at or around, you know, a quarter, at or around 25%, you know, if, you know, 25,000 people, depending on where you are. A lot of the conversation has been along those lines. You know, at Ohio State, for instance, they talked about an 80% reduction of fans in the stands, and that those fans that do come are required to wear masks. Is that a viable plan in your eyes? Can you think that's a plan where you can achieve good social distancing in a group setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think those kinds of interventions are what's going to have to happen if we're going to have spectator sports in particular, you know, returning in the fall. So that does feel viable to me, where, you know, you could have, say, 6-7 seats, you know, in between maybe a group of 2 or 3 people who are maybe roommates or in a family unit, so they're already exposed to each other. Yeah, I think that can work. And I think it's also important to remember that it's a lot harder to spread this thing outdoors than it is indoors. You know, a little bit of wind won't really blow it into somebody else. It'll more disperse it in such a way that it's hard to get. Now, if you're all packed together like we normally are on a fall Saturday in Michigan Stadium, well, that would be a recipe for disaster, I think. But having people that distance apart, I think that could work, yes.
All right. So, you know, as you kind of shift into that thought process of we're outside, you know, we are at reduced capacity in the fall, so making it harder to get. But then there is this suggestion that we hear from experts like yourself. I'm not attributing this comment to you, but from experts in the medical field, that this we could be in store for a fall surge, and not just because more people are out, but that this could, you know, this virus could have a seasonal bend to it. Can you explain why there is, and is there any evidence to that effect? Are we seeing signs of that in the Southern Hemisphere, maybe?
Yeah, so that's a really big question that people are looking at. And I think the general conclusion is that there's a mild seasonal, an increased risk of transmission when the weather's a bit colder and less so during summer-type months. So I think that's probably true, but I think it's going to be a relatively modest effect. So I don't think this is going to go away in the summer. I think it's going to kind of continue at a low level. If we don't practice good social distancing, if we open things up too quickly or people just get sick of it and start going back to the way they interacted in the past, then I think we could easily have a surge in the summer. I think the worries about the fall are multiple. One is the weather is one factor. Trying to get kids back in school is another. Perhaps just fatigue as time goes on with the social distancing. The beginnings of flu season and other viruses that stretch hospital capacity. So I think we just have to be really careful and really smart because, you know, while everybody wants to get back to work, everybody wants the economy open, if we do it too quickly and we have a big surge, everything's going to get shut down again, and that would be, you know, a disaster.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Call this morning here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTKA.com. One of our great friends from over at Michigan Medicine. So another thing that I do, Doc, is I tend to kind of ask you guys about some of the things that I'm sure people are seeing on the news and definitely seeing on social media. So can you give us an update on where we are when it comes to effective treatments? And more specifically, the notion that, you know, a drug that we heard a lot about, hydroxychloroquine, that can be taken prophylactically. Is that something that folks out there in the public should be looking at as a viable plan, you know, for them and their families?
So right now, the answer on the hydroxychloroquine, unfortunately, is that there's zero evidence that it prevents people from getting COVID-19. Some of our first patients that I recall at Michigan Medicine were actually some people who were taking hydroxychloroquine for other diseases they had and got COVID. So that already, you know, created a suggestion, maybe this isn't going to work as a preventative. Having said that, there are multiple large trials, two of which were participating in at Michigan Medicine, to determine, for example, among healthcare workers, whether or not hydroxychloroquine could prevent infection. And that's done in a supervised setting where we know people's medical history, we know the potential risks of the drug. Right now, it is a terrible idea to take hydroxychloroquine to try and prevent disease in the absence of any evidence that it works and some potential for harm. in terms of other treatments, I mean, I think we really are making progress. There's no sort of magic bullet there. We've got probably 6 or 7 clinical trials of everything from stem cells to antiviral medications going at Michigan Medicine to try and help with this effort to figure out how we can treat the various aspects of this disease. And there have been a few things that look really promising. So I'm hopeful as time goes on, part of our toolbox, part of the equation, will be an improved ability to treat people as long as we don't get, you know, completely overwhelmed with numbers.
Right. And another story that's been out there in the media here over the last few weeks is, you know, these trials that they've done with monkeys that have had, you know, encouraging results that this prototype vaccine protects monkeys from the coronavirus. I'm curious your thoughts on that particular, you know, that particular trial or those trials and you know, what kind of timeline, what kind of impact that might have, they might have on the timeline, if any, if you could kind of look down the line for us.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the trials in primates and monkeys, the first trial that really helped us understand the potential for medications was this antiviral called remdesivir, which is made by a company in California called Gilead. We've treated probably close to 50 people with remdesivir in clinical trials and through some other mechanisms at Michigan Medicine. And we know that if you give that medicine, if you give a monkey SARS-CoV-2, so the virus that causes COVID-19, you wait 12 hours, you give them this remdesivir drug, they basically don't get sick. If you give them the infection, the viral infection, and don't give them the medicine, they get really sick. So that's some proof of concept. Humans aren't monkeys, but there's certainly a lot of biologic similarities. So that's promising for that drug, and there's some human evidence that that drug has an effect as well when given later in the disease, because it's real hard to get to people 12 hours after they got infected. In terms of the vaccine news, so that was promising that the vaccine seemed to work to protect monkeys. One of the things about medical research is even when you speed it up massively, it still just takes some time. You cannot, in a month or two, develop a vaccine, throw it out there, you know, give it to hundreds of millions of people. You have to prove it works. You have to prove it's safe. And that process, even though there's so much effort going into it, it just takes some time.
All right, so Doc, one of the troubling aspects of, I mean, every aspect of this fight is troubling when you talk about, you know, some of the horrible numbers that we see. But there, some patterns have emerged that where we see folks with, you know, comorbidities, folks that are in an older age group, they are more at risk. Do you have any thoughts on why we have seen, for instance, folks, African-Americans specifically, you know, some Latino communities as well, be seemingly more susceptible to severe sort of cases when it comes to the coronavirus?
Yeah, that's another million-dollar question, and that's been a really troubling aspect of this. And I think it probably works on a whole bunch of different levels. So part of it may be that folks who live in maybe more crowded conditions, maybe people who are in public transportation more, are more likely to just get exposed. So then you're going to see higher numbers. Groups that have higher rates of smoking, of diabetes, high blood pressure, perhaps because they have poor access to, you know, good medical care, all those kinds of other pre-existing conditions very clearly are risk factors for severe COVID. And there may be many other factors in place in terms of poor access, maybe distrust of the medical community based on previous experiences that may cause people to seek care at a later time point. where it becomes harder to help and more severe disease is likely. And who knows, perhaps there may even be some genetic factors at play. We know, for example, African Americans have some increased risk for kidney disease in certain circumstances, and that may play into this. So I think it's probably a whole host of different factors that lead to that very troubling observation.
I'm talking to Dr. Daniel Call this morning here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTK.com. So Doc, where are we with testing? I ask that same question every week because, you know, with another week, seemingly, or at least hopefully, we make more progress when it comes to testing. So when we talked to Dr. Desmond last week, it was, you know, on the heels of hearing news about the rapid test, the test that, you know, that you could get results in 15 minutes with, that there were some troubling, some troubling news out there about false negatives. 15%, I think, was the number of negatives were false negatives with that particular test. So that is a huge part. Testing capacity is a huge part of us really being able to get on the other side of this, being able to move from mitigation to containment. So have we seen progress when it comes to the accuracy of tests here over the last few weeks? Are you optimistic that we can ramp testing capacity up significantly, say, by the fall?
I think so. I mean, the kind of lab-based tests, so there's two kinds of, well, there's sort of three kinds of tests for viral infection. So there's the kind like you hear about that they're using in the White House or that Jeff Desmond had talked about, which is kind of a machine that isn't really done in a lab. It could be done what we call point of care, like even in a doctor's office, where, you get the swab, you put it in the machine, it spits out a yes, no sort of answer. That machine, if the result is positive, it means you have it, but it does, as you said, miss a significant portion of cases, which is troubling. So there may be circumstances in which you could use that, but its accuracy is certainly an issue. As opposed to, for example, at Michigan Medicine, we have multiple different sort of what they call platforms, different ways we do the test in a laboratory with technicians. Those tests are much better in terms of they don't really have a lot of false positives. If the virus is in the nose, we're going to find it most likely with those tests. Now, those can take anywhere from an hour and a half once the specimen gets in the lab to, say, 8 hours, where it's often resulted overnight. So, you know, that speed of use depends on what you need it for. Say, for example, you know, you wanted to, just to get back to sports, right, if you wanted to test all the athletes, say, you know, before a game or something, you know, to have a rapid test that you could do right then, might be kind of useful. You
right.
could also do it using a lab-based test. So I think our capacity is ramping up. You know, we have a lot of capacity. We have more capacity than we need right now to do tests. But we worry about all these supplies and the swabs and the reagents and these machines running 24/7 can start to kind of wear out and need parts that can be sometimes hard to get. I know that sounds a little funny, but that is the fact that it's all these other sort of outside things about testing if we're trying to do, you know, a million tests a day in the country. But I think we've definitely made progress.
Gotcha. All right, so my last one before we talk about, how folks, at this stage, you know, getting out to University of Michigan Hospital, getting some of those elective surgeries that maybe people were putting off, now is the time to really, you know, do that, to get back, to get to some of that clinical care as well. I want to touch on that after, Doc, you kind of touch on a real serious question or concern for a lot of us parents out there. Now, you're a parent, but you're talking about college-age kids. Now, while there will be some risk returning to a college environment, a campus environment, you know that you are dealing with an age group that when you talk about practicing you know, good social distancing, they'll know what that means, right? Conceptually, you know, they're mature enough to grasp the importance of that. When you have a six-year-old, you're talking about, you know, kindergarten and grade school kids, might be a little harder concept for them to grasp. And so the fear that a lot of parents have about their children going back to school in the fall and how you might be able to achieve good social distancing in class settings with kids of that age group, how much of a risk do you anticipate that being, and what's maybe a remediation plan as far as that's concerned, or a mitigation plan as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, I mean, that is a real challenge, isn't it? I mean, it's even a challenge when you think about this weekend and trying to, say, have a few people over and do good social distancing. But if you've got little kids running around, it becomes very difficult to do. So, you know, I would say first, God bless the elementary school teachers and the aides and everybody working
yes.
in that setting, because it is going to be a
yes.
challenge. And you know, I think they're probably the best to figure out how to make it into some, they're used to trying to teach kids rules and how to make some new rules. And so I think we'll probably, I know the school districts are struggling now to think, you know, how can we get things going so these kids can learn, so the parents can get back to work in the fall. And so some of the things I've heard that make sense to me are, maybe you have a more limited schedule where some kids go Monday and Wednesday and other kids go Tuesday and Thursday. You know, so you've got half as many kids there at one time, so that you can spread them out a little bit. You know, there may be some activities, play activities and things at recess that have to be done in a different way. You know, maybe like the gym class has to look a little bit different. I think it's a massive challenge. I think it's one of the biggest things public health authorities are worried about, because, you know, as we know, children generally do okay with this disease. There are these very frightening kind of inflammatory syndromes you may have seen reports of, where kids can get really sick more because of their immune response to the virus in kind of a delayed way. But then there's also the worry, if we're going to have an outbreak, are our kids going to school is going to be kind of the vectors for that? Are they going to be the ones that get sick and mm-hmm. bring it home to mom and dad, and mom and dad take it to work, you know? And so these are just massive problems that are going to require an enormous amount of thought, experimentation, testing to try and stay on top of.
Right. All right. So, Doc, as I kind of previewed a couple of moments ago, you know, the University of Michigan and hospitals everywhere, there had to be a shift to, you know, COVID preparedness, right? All resources, all hands on deck, so to speak, really had to be focused on the response to that. At the expense of, you know, some of the more elective treatments and surgeries that folks would come to the hospital for. But, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys are back and ready and open for business when it comes to maybe some of those elements that people have been putting off.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we are really worried about is people, one, who may have emergencies. They may think they're having a stroke. They may think they're having a heart attack, or, shortness of breath from a blood clot or something like that, where they really need urgent medical care and it can be life-saving. And we know there are cases where people have been afraid to come to the emergency rooms, both here in Michigan and elsewhere, haven't come and haven't survived that event. And so it's safe to come to the emergency room. We have all sorts of things in place. We're by no means, out of control or overrun with COVID patients. We've got lots of ways to protect people. So the risk of staying home if you have, you know, one of those concerning symptoms is far, far greater than the risk of acquiring anything in the hospital setting. And then outside of the emergency room, you know, we just had to stop doing a whole bunch of things, even for a while, most of our transplants, because we were worried, were we going to have enough dialysis machines? Were we going to have enough ICU beds? So that concern is entirely past. We have all the resources that we need to get people back into care. So people who have, for example, you know, I had a friend who had, a breast lump that was malignant that needed to be taken out. That got delayed. Now it's time to get that stuff done again. They may not be emergencies, but they are urgent. You want to get at it before, you know, it spreads and becomes harder to cure. So, yeah, we really are encouraging people to get back into both their routine and their kind of semi-urgent medical care, things that they put off. We've got all sorts of things in place where we've moved the chairs in the waiting room apart a bit, where we've got, plexiglass shields up, where we've got different room cleaning. So, you know, we've got a lot of experts in infection control here. We're fortunate at Michigan Medicine to have that, who've really thought hard about how to make it a safe environment.
Well, Dr. Call, look, man, I know the folks listening, share this sentiment with me, but thank you so much, you know, for all you and your colleagues are doing on the front lines. I cannot express enough how thankful we are for folks that are putting themselves, folks like you, that are putting themselves at some risk, obviously, and doing that balancing, that juggling act, where you are caring for others, and then you have your own families to be concerned with as well. That is not lost on me, nor is it lost on many of the folks listening. So thank you for that, and thank you a ton for coming on this morning and taking 30 minutes of time, crucial time out of your day, to come inform us. We really, truly appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks a lot. That was Dr. Daniel Call from Michigan Medicine, doing a tremendous job. Our friends over at the University of Michigan Infectious Diseases Internal Medicine gave you some important information on wearing masks. Ira, how many times have we, this seems to be like the easiest thing that it takes little effort. It causes no, I even struggle to see the inconvenience of it. Doesn't seem that hard to do. Yet there are a lot of folks out there, hey, I don't think there's any risk to me. I'm willing to take the risk. But it's not your risk. It's the risk you pose to others. Hopefully we are shifting the thought process on that. Gave some other valuable information as well. And, of course, they are open for business at the University of Michigan Hospital for all of those maybe elective treatments or some of those treatments that have been postponed. Time to go back and get those taken care of. We got to get to a break. Back on the other side with our good friend, Coach Eric Backich, and a landmark proposal in college baseball that he is a part of. He'll come on the other side to talk about that here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, The Ticket, the official voice of University of Michigan Sports, Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.